Rated T to M.
You've met Andrew Ryan and visited the underwater world of Rapture. You might have encountered the malevolent AI Shodan and a collective species of alien that calls itself the Many. However, chances are you haven't heard the stories of the individuals who bring both these characters and the worlds that they inhabit into being. In this podcast, we tell these tales in our own words. Really, it's not about who here does what, but how who we are informs our contributions to a rational studio culture, as well as the games we make. I'm Sean Elliott, and this is Irrational Behavior. Do game makers game differently? In this episode, we ask whether designers are able to turn off their critical filters and play the parts of consumers. We grill guys here who play multiplayer games together about their group dynamics, how they assess their own roles and rate one another. And throughout the episode, individuals in the studio tell us about games that are influential and that they offer important lessons for games of all genres. Audio director Jim Bonney.
EA's Dead Space is a sci-fi horror action game, and it's got some really great sound design to make it a very immersive experience. One of the coolest things I thought about it was that you can hear the main character's heartbeat the entire time, and I didn't notice that until I'd actually isolated a certain section of the game and I was watching it. There was an alien at the far end of this corridor kind of crawling toward me, and I shot it as it was coming toward me, but when I went back to listen to it again, I realized I could hear my heartbeat beating normally, boom, 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 boom. Boom, boom. But as the alien got closer, it started beating faster and faster. Boom, 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 boom. Then I shot the alien, and my heartbeat went slowly back to normal. And it was a great subconscious use of audio to create more tension. And certainly the best example I can think of that illustrates great subconscious sound design.
Art lead Sean Robertson.
So this game, Condemned, first Condemned that came out. We were working on Bioshock at the time, and we were having a lot of trouble with how do we make it scary? We've got these Scooby-Doo monsters, which I'm sure everyone's seen, Yamhand and all these guys that just, you know, were like jump out of the closet guys, not really working. Like, how do you make something scary? I started playing Condemned, and I was like, these people are like humans. You know, they're normal people. They may be jacked up on some crazy drug or something like that, but they scare the hell out of me, and they do very simple things. Like, there's not overly elaborate setups. Like, you just walk into a room, and a guy comes at you with a pipe, gives you a whack, and then he runs away. Instead of having an extended fight with the guy, now I'm like, well, where the hell is he? Like, I don't want to walk around this corner and have him whack me again with his pipe. You know, rather than him just sticking around and letting me fight him out, you know, all of a sudden you're seeing these guys coming in, you know, opportunistic hit, and then taking off, and then using more of the environment, like they could pick up other weapons too, weapons that were stronger. And sometimes they did things where you could sort of see them hiding around a corner, so you know that was coming up. But even then, you knew that they were going to do some crazy shit jumping out at you, and you weren't quite sure which animation they're going to use. So it was a very simple system, I guess, to me, the end user. I don't know how simple it was to implement, but very effective on really ramping up the fear level. And making us realize here that, you know, like, humans can be scary. We don't have to have big monster masks on and ooey-gooey jelly monsters.
Part 1. Team Deathmatch. Multiplayer shooters are a lot like team sports. Intra-team rivalries are inevitable among people who regularly play together. And at Irrational, these people have to work together after the trash talk.
What's it like to play multiplayer games with you schlubs?
It turns into a big shit show.
IT assistant Ray Holbrook.
It's unbelievable. Once we get going, everyone just starts ripping on everyone in the room.
You want us to name names here?
Yeah, name as many names as you want, especially if they come from
just
within
one.
The studio.
Just one. Wow,
Joe Falstick.
I'm not going that
hard. Joe's the general Falstick.
The general.
Backseat gamer.
The tiniest general.
Now, in Joe's defense, he was in the military for 3.5 weeks.
Office manager Ryan Audie.
So, I mean, he does have more training than any of us in regards to tactical shooters.
Oh, wow.
who's got the worst temper?
What's that?
Who's got the worst
Ray.
Temper?
Oh, I'll go off.
Oh, yeah. Ray. Ray flips out.
I'll stop muting people, and then I left. I shut my Xbox off the other night.
And that's when the Boston accent really comes out on Ray.
Art director Nate Wells.
When he's screaming at some noob.
Strike!
Oh, these mortars. Oh, man, what the hell were those? Those mortar strikes the other night.
Mortar strikes.
Yeah, but how do you get them?
Correct.
Oh, man.
A fucking mortar strike.
It didn't really help that I wasn't in your squad. And I was on just some random squad.
That's right.
Well, that's always the best, right? When we've got, you know, 10 people playing, but it's 9 people to a team. So that one poor guy we work with is always on the
kind of like
team.
When we wouldn't back out for Joe Fosdick anymore.
Yeah. Kind of like when the general would show up and we'd try and fill the room just before he'd sign on. Yeah, exactly.
Bloop.
Kind of, kind of exactly like that.
I'd like to bring up the intermission chat.
Principal artist Scott Sinclair.
You know, in the lobbies when you're waiting for the next map to roll. Like, I know I'm behind a mic and nobody can see me or knows who I am, but I still am made so uncomfortable by a few of you guys.
Yeah, well, Ryan just will sit
Ryan
there, and it will be dead silence, and he'll just pick a gamer tag and just start wailing on the kid. Like, the kid's done nothing, and the younger the kid, the more shit he gets. Like, if it's clearly a 12-year-old, like, the gloves come off, you know.
The candy comes out.
You actually see the ESRB rating burst into flames on the screen.
Listen, I'm just saying statistically, odds are those kids don't have a father at home, and I call them out for it instantly without being remote. You know, it's just playing the numbers game.
Exactly.
Oh, I actually did that the other night. The baby was crying in the background. I'm like, why don't you go pay attention to your kid? And he goes, why don't you mind your own business? I'm like, who's watching your kid? The pit bull? I'm like, come on. Because you hear the dog barking in the background. I'm like, come on. Who's watching the kids here? He's like, mind your own business. And he logged off. And I'm like, oh, he just ripped on him for like 20 minutes.
No, we're all pretty decent people for the most part. Yeah, you put that gamer tag in front of our
name. Oh, it's bad.
You get who we are. And it's like some of the most horrible things. Like, I'm appalled at the stuff I say.
Yeah.
Like, it's just horrific.
And if Modern Warfare didn't get rid of the party chat, it wouldn't happen.
That's
what it comes down to.
That's on them. That's not our fault.
You know?
How would you guys, like, when Scott's not present, assume he's not here, how do you guys, like, describe him? Like, what's his role, like, in your game?
Rage quitting.
Yeah, Scott's...
Am I?
No. No, not at all.
Scott's the emotion of the team. You know, if things are going really well, he's really pumped up and kind of carrying that vibe. And if things are going bad, he usually signs off, so...
Fabricated.
He's good, though. You're good. I mean, your kill to death is pretty solid.
I'm lucky.
You're a good shooter.
I'm lucky.
It's those kills you're stealing of mine, dude. That's what the problem is.
I mean, then you get the, like, the stat whore people who are like... Which is kind of like Tynan. He always knows what everybody else's KDR is. It is.
Yeah, he's got, you know, he's got his, like, legal pad out with, like,
check out
all
the
numbers written down.
Decide if that's a person he should even know.
Trying to find patterns.
Well, I don't have to be nice to that guy tomorrow, because look at his fucking KDR.
Ray, you dropped 3 points. What was that all about?
You're embarrassing yourself, kid.
Little brother, right?
What's, like, the most, like, incriminating shit you've heard inadvertently come through someone's headset?
I'll call myself out. I've actually been busted, like, giving the wife baby talk with vent mic open.
What I was hoping to hear.
And that was actually, like, one of the most embarrassing moments of my entire life.
What did you do? How did you try to
It's like my hardcore, like, WoW crew, you know, and we're in the middle of a raid, and, like, I'm just mashing the vent button, you know, and, like, trying to hang out with her at the same time. And then I realized, like, wow, vent got real quiet, you know, and somebody was like, did you hear that? Did anybody record that? You know, and I'm like, oh, fuck, are they talking about me?
So, like, what were you telling her, man? Recreate that moment for everyone.
Oh, I can't do that. You know, that schmooky pooky crap.
Let's hear your specific brand of it.
Oh, I'm not going to do that. I won't be doing that here.
I'll rub your feet later, honey.
Yeah, I always hear a lot of audio coming through those mics in our crew that sounds like water moving through a pipe.
Yeah, a lot of...
I don't know what that is. Never been able to figure that out.
I've described that, a bubbling noise.
It's very strange. A lot of that.
So pretend Nate's not here now. What's the story on him? What roles he
played? I actually came up with a new name for him recently. I call him Magoo. Because he kind of, like, I'll be following him and ready to criticize him. And somehow, you know, I'm dead. And the next thing I know, he's top of the leaderboard. And he's, like, sort of blindly stumbled through the win on his own. You know?
Yeah, but Nate, but trying to get Nate into a game, he's so shady because he always leaves his Xbox on during the day, night. And then it's set to away. And then you join him. And he just disappears out of the room. And then you invite him and he doesn't come in.
So what do you guys speculate on what he's doing? You have to be like, you're not sitting there.
I know what he's doing. I live with you. You just leave that shit on. TV would be on white noise like for 24 hours.
So what about Ryan?
Ryan's the
loudmouth.
Talented, Yeah, loudmouth juggernaut. The guy that makes me cringe on Xbox
chat.
The
guy who makes the loading menus fun.
Yeah.
Well, he's always at the top. He's loud.
Ryan is notorious for knowing, you know, what he can squeeze in the last 5 seconds before a lobby closes and the game loads, so nobody can, you know, come back at him. You know, issue that last second challenge, or, you know, this is going to hurt so bad, you know, it's going to affect your mother in some way. Like,
yeah.
And then, you know, the game loads, so they have no way to come back. And then it always makes the lobby after that match incredibly uncomfortable when we got our asses handed to us.
Yeah, usually when it was America,
you have to sit there and sort of accept defeat. Yeah. Like, yeah, you guys did good.
With a minute left, we'll start the plan. All right, guys, as soon as this game is over, everyone back out instantly. Like, I'll send you invites.
You've said that so many times. Like, get ready. The minute this match is over, we're backing out.
Let's break Ray down.
Let's break it down, Ray. Started off with the overinflated sense of self-worth, I heard.
Yeah, I mean, Ray. Yeah, I mean, when Modern Warfare 2 came out, you wouldn't play with us because you were so concerned about your win-to-loss ratio. You had to play with your...
You remember, remember how upset we got, too? We were talking so much about Ray, so still, good.
Yeah, you're like, upset. Fuck Ray. Fuck Ray. Fine. Fuck. He can play whatever the fuck he wants.
But secretly, we all hope he invites us.
Yeah. But I hope I get a chance to play with
Ray. Ray's the guy you want to play with.
Yeah. Ray's the good one.
Yeah, you just see him disappear across the battle, like behind a house, and then it's like, there's like six kills. You don't even want to know what went on behind that house.
You're just tactical, dude. Like, you see a few guys moving, you know where to jump in to make, you know, cover the blinds.
I think I've studied the maps enough.
You make me feel like Mutt and Jeb. Like, am I doing good, Ray? Is that good, Ray? Am I covering where you want me to cover, Ray? Ray, Ray, wait up! Wait up, Ray!
You know, like, oh, he's on the other team.
Yeah, there have been many times where I've just, like, tried to get seriously behind Ray as a meat shield. Just to, like, see what happens. I know he's going to just cut like Moses through the Red Sea and end up on the other side of the map where I can hide in a bush.
You're on his back.
Like a huge pussy.
Screaming.
Programmer Shane Matthews.
One of the games that I try to get everybody to play, or at least that I keep talking about whenever someone talks about realism in video games, is Desert Bus. This game came out for the Sega CD quite a while ago, back when, you know, like the politicians say, oh, violence in video games, blah, 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 games need to be, you know, less violent, more like real life, that sort of thing. So Penn and Teller had commissioned to create a bunch of mini-games, and one of them was called Desert Bus. And, you know, it was a satire. The point was that you are a bus driver going from Tucson, Arizona to Las Vegas. And that stretch of highway is flat, and it's full of absolutely nothing. You start right at the beginning, and it says, hey, you know, can you go from here to here and drive there? And you have to drive it in real time, not going over the speed limit because your bus doesn't go that fast. It goes like maybe 50 miles per hour. So it takes you something like, I don't know, 6 hours to get from Tucson to Las Vegas. At that time, you see stops where you could pick up people if there were any people there, but there aren't. So if you'd like, you could stop or you could just keep going. And you can't just press forward because the bus just slightly veers to the right the entire time. And if at any point you accidentally let the bus veer too much to the right, it gets stuck in the side. And then, in real time, a tow truck has to bring you back to wherever you came from. So in this case, Tucson. And once again, that's in real time. So if you've been driving for 3 hours, now the tow truck has to bring you back for 3 hours of you just looking forward as you're going backwards. Every once in a while, you see a little stone on the side, and even more rare than that, a bug might hit your windshield and stay there. But these are really the only output that you get from the game. Finally, after doing this for, you know, 6 or so hours, you get to Las Vegas, and this gigantic scoreboard comes up, and it's tallying numbers, tick, 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 and then it'll add just one to your score. And then it'll ask, and it'll say, great job. Would you like to do the return trip? And so you can just go back the way that you just came, back to Tucson, and then it'll say, you know, tick, 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 tick. Now you're up to 2 points. Would you like to go back? And even though it's got a gigantic scoreboard, you can actually only do this 99 times before the game just ends. Now, if you did do it 99 times, it would take you a little over 40 days of playing to actually get that score. And I just love the idea of a game that takes realism to a whole new level. Just takes boredom in realism to a whole new level. And every time that somebody is like, oh, we need more realism in video games, or no, that's not how things work in real life, you know, you just say to those guys, you want realism, go fucking play Desert Bus.
I'm Sean Elliott, associate producer, and I wanted to chime in about something I think is brilliant about the Battlefield series. In most cooperative team games, you're ostensibly working together, but the extent of your knowledge of the other person is just happenstance. You just happen to be next to someone. You're trying your damnedest to catch up to them and play alongside them. But for the most part, you end up hitting tab on a PC shooter or something to look at the scoreboard and compare. You see, like, how am I doing in relation to my friends? I have, like, 5 more points than them, or they're, like, 8 points ahead of me. I need to catch up. One of the brilliant things that the Battlefield series introduced with Battlefield 2 was the notion of a squad system. And what that meant is that not only do you have a separate channel for text or voiceover speech that you can communicate with one another without, you know, disturbing the rest of the people on your entire team, but then you could spawn on someone who was designated a squad leader. And that in itself was a nice idea, because then you have to battle who's going to be our squad leader, you know, who's up to this position. And that ended up entailing its own duties, because it meant that in order to spawn on that person had to remain alive. So they couldn't be the Rambo of the group. You know, you didn't want the squad leader rushing in and throwing grenades everywhere and shooting his rockets off and stuff, because if he bit it, you were all going to have to go back to one of your either the points that you had captured, your aircraft carrier, your airbase, you know, whatever the options were. And even better, in Battlefield Bad Company 2, they've reduced the size of the squad from 5 to 4 in total, and they've made it now so that you can spawn, there's no longer a designated leader, and you can spawn on anyone who's alive in the squad. The media plus is that, once again, you're right there with one another, you spawn in, you're looking, when you look at the map, you're looking at their positions, and so you're getting feedback, like, okay, this guy's here. And even when you separate, it's like, okay, we're actually doing a flank maneuver, or we're separating the eggs into multiple baskets so that if the two guys on the right flank are killed, we still have the option to spawn on the guys on the left flank. It just means that you're with one another all the time. And it's so important in a cooperative game, because it's not just about checking the scoreboard, but now you're actually seeing it. You see the rocket come out of your teammate's launcher and hit a Jeep and kill all 3 guys riding in it. And that watch me, mom, moment is just really, really key. I mean, you feel like that sense of exhilaration when not only have you had a personal accomplishment, but all of your best friends witnessed it firsthand because they happen to be in proximity to you. Part 2, Appetite for Deconstruction. Do all devs here play games like designers, or can they play games for the fun of it? Becoming designers changed their habits, or were their habits unusual well before they became professionals? How has becoming game developers changed the way that you actually play games?
I was trying to break every game I played from pretty much day one.
Tech designer Justin Sonicalb.
Even before I was a developer, like, you know, Deus Ex, I tried to figure out, like, you know, how to climb the walls with the wall mines, or Baldur's Gate, finding, you know, 50 different ways to abuse time stop. All these different powers, I'm always trying to sort of figure out, what haven't the developers thought of? What have the designers of this game missed that I can exploit to, you know, gain godlike power within the context of this game? I think that that's something that really comes in handy, both for QA people and for designers, is just this, like, understanding of where the common failures are in a game's design.
Does that go for everyone? You think that's common among people who do end up getting into game development, where you play with an awareness that you're interacting with a construct, essentially? You know, you're not getting wrapped up in the experience, as opposed to, you know, someone goes and sees a Bruckheimer movie, mm-hmm. and they're like, they think these people are real. The woman in the front row who's screaming, like, don't go in that room, you know? I mean, you are game developers naturally the ones from the very beginning who are, like, someone wrote that scene.
I always thought it was kind of reversed cause and effect.
Principal combat designer Kenneth Strickland.
You go in and become a game designer and do it for a while, and then that awareness of how to break things grows out of that. You know, to some degree, I'm sure everybody starts with a different mix of it. But I find myself turning that sense on either on a second playthrough, or if a game fails to grab me. Like, if somebody gets me into that Bruckheimer experience, or if I'm really kind of enraptured with the world, I'll just kind of run with it. I won't kind of sit there and deconstruct it. It usually comes later.
In your experience, do you guys tend to start deconstructing things when they're going wrong more so than when they're going right?
Well, it's interesting. For me,
lead designer Bill Gardner,
I tend to start really looking at what designers and developers are doing and trying to figure out what's making the game tick with two states. If the game is actually really, really terrible or really, really good. If it's really terrible, I'll start tearing it. The second I see a bug, it's like you see the boom mic in a film or whatever. You see some sort of bug and you're like, oh, okay, what the fuck are these jackasses doing? You start tearing it apart and really like, okay, what do they do wrong? What can I learn from this? And you just really tear into it. Conversely, if a game is exceptional, like recently with God of War 3, playing the intro, climbing up Mount Olympus on the back of Gaia and just trying to break it down and really like, okay, what are they doing with the FOV here and the camera and like really break it down because, you know, when something amazes you, you know, you want to dissect it and figure out what can we learn from this. So I think it's just the extremes. When you're in the middle, I tend to be able to shut my mind off a lot more and just sort of enjoy it. I think I tend to play a lot more of like mediocre games because of it just so I can just shut my mind off and play. But yeah, for me, it's about the extremes.
Yeah, but there's also not a whole lot of point to being in the industry if you don't have a passion for it, right? And I guess that's what I'm afraid of. Like, if I'm not consciously trying to block that analysis, I'm worried that I'll just stop enjoying it.
Yeah, I think especially back to the idea of are you predisposed to want to break the experience? I think if I had been like that,
senior effects artist Steven Alexander,
I would have been less likely to want to make games because I had to be in love with them and the experience first for it to be something that I was like, I want to create that. If I had just been about, like, total deconstruction from day one, it wouldn't. I mean, I also went to film school, and film school ruined movies for me for quite a long time. Like, there was a period where I couldn't go to a movie without doing exactly what we're talking about, which is I would step out of it and just intellectually deconstruct everything as it came. I could never immerse myself. And thankfully with games, I can kind of turn that on and off.
I think everybody has a personal threshold to which, like, you know, spotting an error or, you know, wow, that's just a really bad tactical space or that's a terrible texture will, like, you know, briefly break their concentration and kind of pull them out of that immersive experience. I remember there was, like, one moment in episode 2 of Half-Life 2 where there was just something wrong about the tactical space, and all of a sudden all that real momentum that, you know, your constant rush to, you know, barrel forward and save Alex, it was broken for me just a bit. And that was enough to make me go, hey, wait a minute. They're doing this, and this other thing to make me feel a sense of panic about, you know, Alex. And it's working. What happens if I just, you know, stop here and twiddle my thumbs for a bit? There's no real Alex who's actually, you know, going to die here. So, you know, all it takes is just one thing to kind of break that immersion, and then there's almost the sense of, what the heck? You know, I'm being strung along here in an innate, you know, sort of rebellion to that.
If you want to break yourself of the habit of looking at games analytically, I think the more Blizzard games you play, the better you're going to get at turning your mind off. They're masters of their craft, and you look at things like, you know, how are they handling the drop rates and things like that. I think you could very easily turn yourself off to their games if you actually went in and like look at some of the numbers. And I think to some level you can do this. Obviously, you can go on Thoughtbot or whatever it is, go on various websites and figure out exactly what the drop rates are. And that just to me is the exact wrong way to approach these games. And for a while, you know, I was playing WoW early on, you know, and Diablo by extension, you know, look at some of the drop rates and things like that. And that just sucks all the magic out of it. And I just you want to understand what kind of like tricks are they doing? Well, are they putting their hand on the scale in terms of the drop rates, you know, to make sure that you're going to keep you hooked and things like that. But after doing that for a few months, I just said, this is killing the experience. This is much more about the numbers for me rather than like, holy shit, I got this awesome purple or, you know, whatever it is. So obviously it's very important to be able to analyze these games to be successful as a developer. But I think Blizzard is a good way to train yourself to shut yourself off because I think you can very easily turn to the dark side and ruin the Blizzard's games.
For me, if I see an effect that is just I've never seen or maybe it's a material or some piece of art, you know, where I'm like, this is really stellar. God of War has a lot of this kind of stuff because their artwork is so great. And I will just stop playing the game and go like stick my nose against the wall, or I'll just keep throwing grenades. You know, like, you know, there's great weapon effects and stuff in the new Battlefield. And like, I'll stop. Everything else is going on around me. I'll find a corner and I'll just fire grenades at different things, you know, just to see what various effects are going to play and, you know, how much they take into account the material types, think it also has to do with the game you're making. Depending on what you're making and how relevant, you know, like how directly parallel it is to the game you're playing, you're more likely to start deconstructing because you want to see how they solved problems that you're encountering.
Do you find that playing with friends now and then helps you see games more like a casual consumer and less like a developer?
There are so many just things we as gamers assume and take on in our collective memory of playing games that to somebody like my girlfriend who when she tries to play BioShock or whatever, she'll try and do something. I'll be like, why isn't that working? And it would never in a million years occur to me that that should do anything, you know, because in every other game, every other first-person shooter I've ever played, you can't do that. And so I'm like, well, it's just like that. You know, like there's just a... There's a lot of just ingrained rules, you know, like about like where you can and can't go, what will and won't break, you know, that kind of stuff. That
yeah, but if we want to grow an audience, right? Those are,
oh yeah, exactly. No, it always makes me think like, yeah, what if we did change that? And a lot of the times the rules are the reasons for those rules are just that from a production standpoint, it would be impossible to support that kind of play.
But if somehow we could give those casual players, you know, at least a fictional justification or at least knowledge that the boundary exists, right, then suddenly we've made it a lot more palatable to them.
I think that there's some limits on that. For instance, my girlfriend asked me, so wait a minute, you can just keep taking an infinite number of bullets in Call of Duty? Like, you know, you recover, but like there's no limit to the number of times really that your character can get shot. And, you know, as a designer, I fundamentally understand like the justification for that. And in fact, you know, I agree with it. But for somebody who's approaching games from the outside and doesn't understand like the justification that's in the mechanics, the fictional liberty taken there is just, it's very unpalatable. Yeah, it was just like around time number 5 that I got shot and then went back undercover and she's like, what the heck, you've been shot 5 times now and you're not dead?
Designer Justin Pappas.
Stalker is this Russian-developed game. It's like a post-apocalyptic survival RPG. It takes place around Chernobyl. And there's a lot of cool mods for it. There's this one really awesome realism mod called Stalker Redux. So in most games, hunger and like needing to eat is a pain in the ass. You know, if the game is about like shielding fireballs and sword-slashing enemies, then having to stop and eat Twinkies and whatnot is generally a pain in the butt. But in a game that's about, like, survival in a wasteland like Stalker, hunger helps to create some amazing situations. It also drives the player, I think, to explore, you know, instead of just sort of go back and forth between the town and the dungeon. They want to explore side areas in hopes of finding the resources they need in order to survive, you know, Twinkies and potato chips and whatnot. In Stalker, with this Redux mod attached, you have to eat food in order to survive. And if you don't eat food, every once in a while, your health bar starts to drain very slowly, and you'll eventually die. I foolishly had been out in the field far too long, and had eaten all my food, thinking that once I got back to the camp, I could just buy food from the vendor there. And so night started to fall, and so I headed back to camp. And when I got there, to my surprise, the vendor did not have any food to sell. And my health bar was starting to slowly drain. I couldn't go out into the dark to look for food because in this Redux mod, the dark was incredibly oppressive. It was nearly impossible to see, and it was very dangerous to go out. And I had already looted everything in the area surrounding the camp. So I went out to my stalker brothers around the campfire, playing guitar, laughing, and I thought surely one of them would be glad to trade some ammo for some food. They all had food, but not a single one of them wanted to trade with me. They had in the past, but for some reason, this night, they were married to their cans of tuna and sausage links. And so I did what I had to do. I sat in the shadows and I watched these guys that I knew had food, and I waited for one of them to get up and go back to his bedroll in one of the little, you know, decrepit houses that was on the outskirts of this camp. And when he did that, I followed him. And when he fell asleep, I killed him. I killed a man for his sausage, and I still carry the guilt. And no game has ever forced me to so compromise my morals as the Stalker Redux mod. And I think it was because of this hunger mechanic.
So Saints Row 2 is stigmatized by a lot of enthusiasts as being kind of like a heartless cash-in game. Open-world crime games like Grand Theft Auto were popular, and they saw Saints Row as an attempt to, let's do more of the same, essentially, except it's got our publisher's brand on it. But I think that cynicism missed out on some extraordinarily smart design. One thing that Saints Row 2 did that's absolutely commendable is to take subversive gameplay that emerges through, you know, players just fucking around and systematize it and reward players for it. And then not only that, introduce it to players who had never considered to do these things. One example is that people walk around in this kind of open world game and they see that when they get hit by a vehicle, their character goes flying. They love the ragdoll physics and, you know, they fly over a street sign and land on a park bench. So what Saints Row 2 did was turn that into an insurance racket game so that you're essentially making money. The more spectacular your disaster is, the more money that you're going to make off of it. And this is the kind of thing I had in mind when I asked people to come in and talk about games, that even if they weren't their favorites of all times, were nonetheless influential, or at least are something that other designers can look at, regardless of the genre of game that they're making. All right, all right. This podcast was produced by Jim Bonney and Sean Elliott. Music provided by Patrick Balthrop, The Razors, Signal Hill, and Rich Vreeland and Disaster Peace.
Do you like ranking up?
Do you like ranking the fuck up? Well, then come to our website, www.irrationalgames.com.